Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My very special guest today is Michael Madsen, director of the new documentary film Into Eternity. Into Eternity is a film about the vast amounts of radioactive waste created every day by nuclear power plants the world over and the constant challenge to find an adequate way to store it. A review of the film in The Guardian said, "Jaw-dropping. Tackles a subject almost beyond comprehension. One of the most extraordinary factual films to be shown this year. Madsen's film does not merely ask tough questions about the implications of nuclear energy, but about how we, as a race, conceive our own future." Michael Madsen is a film director and conceptual artist who has been guest lecturer at the Royal Danish Academy of Art, the Danish Film School, and the Danish School of Design. He is the director of several documentaries, including the award-winning To Damascus, a film on interpretation produced in 2005. Michael Madsen joins us now on the phone from Denmark. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Michael.
Thank you very much.
I think I'd like to ask you first, how did you conceive to do a film about nuclear waste? What was it that initiated your interest in the whole thing?
Essentially, it was the 100,000-year aspect that somebody in Finland is building a facility that has to last in a foolproof manner for 100,000 years. That was what caught my attention, because I thought that first of all, these persons, these experts, they will have to be able to relate to understand what 100,000 years is, which I think is very, very difficult. And secondly, they will have to have some kind of scenarios for the future, some ideas about how the future will look like in this time span. And that is what got me really, really interested. And then I thought that this has to be the first time in the history of mankind that we are building something like this, and also something which is not in any kind of religious context, as would be the case with the cathedrals of the Middle Ages or the pyramids. So my basic question has been, throughout making this film, what does such a facility tell us about our own time? What is its sort of true significance? Perhaps it's something beyond being a storage place for nuclear waste. So these are the things that I was trying to look into.
Well, what do you mean by that last statement? Perhaps it's something beyond being a storage facility for nuclear waste. What do you mean by that, Michael?
Well, I had this kind of suspicion that this is not just digging a hole in the ground and essentially building a kind of a bunker-like structure. And I think that the aspect of the facility where this shows most clearly is that this facility is built in a way so that it is able to operate without any human interference. Once it is completed about 120 years from now, it'll be sealed off and then it'll enter and kind of silent mode operation. And the reason why this facility has to be independent of human surveillance and power supply, which is, of course, the case with any such interim facility in the world today, where the waste is, these pools that will cooling the waste, etc. The reason for this silent mode element is that in this time span, the scientist simply does not expect civilization as we know today to last. That means that the knowledge about what nuclear energy is, and therefore what radiation is, will simply vanish at one point. And therefore, it is not considered possible that that any kind of, you can say that, that it has to be independent of what we humans know in the future, because otherwise it would be too dangerous. It's more safe if it can operate by itself. And that is because you can say that this facility, the Junkalo facility in Finland, is the first, possibly, as one critic said or wrote, possibly the first post-human structure on Earth. I mean, it, in its very construction, it has the notion that civilization as we know today will not last for this time span.
Or maybe humanity.
Well, I can tell you that some of the scientists that I've been working with for this film, they, in a way, have expressed less concern in terms of the danger, at least towards humans, because, yes, it is conceivable that mankind will not last for this long. And I can also tell you that in the Swedish legislation concerning nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste, the talk is about creatures, living creatures, and not just humans.
Interesting. Well, yeah. There are several questions I have then, Michael. I've always thought that the waste, and I think the EPA in America, Environmental Protection Agency, or some such agency, says it should be isolated from the environment actually for 500,000 years, not 100,000 years.
It's 1,000,000 years in the US.
1,000,000. Well, therefore, yes. Why are you using the figure of 100,000 when it is 1,000,000 in the US?
Yes, that's a very, very good question. I'm using the figure of 100,000 years in into eternity because that is what the law in Finland states.
Oh, it's the law in
so
Finland.
So in Finland, this is the quarantine time, so to say. And I can't tell you why it's only 100,000 years in Finland and 1,000,000 years in the US. I think that the only thing that these two figures really tell us is that the experts do not agree about how long is this actually dangerous.
Well, why do they put the figure at 1,000,000 years in the US then, Michael?
Well, I don't know. I simply don't know. I know that there may be some differences in how sort of the legal system works in the U.S., as I think we all know, and it may have something to do with that. One independent nuclear waste scientist whom I consulted in making the film so that I would have somebody to sort of verify what I was being told by the participating experts in the film, and also just to make sure that I got the points. She told me that it should be at least 250,000 years. But one of the problems and one of the unknowns in making such a facility is that we don't have any experience with nuclear waste in such concentrations as will be the case in such a repository. What happens inside the waste is unknown, because nuclear waste does not only contain plutonium and uranium. In the process, inside a reactor in a nuclear power plant, almost every known element in the universe is created. And that means that the exact composition of the waste is not entirely known. And what will happen inside the reactions that goes on in the waste is not fully clear.
Yes, there was a fair bit of work done on that by scientists relating to Yucca Mountain, where the US decided to store its 64,000 tons of civilian radioactive waste in a volcanic mountain made of actually pumice, which is just ash from the volcano. And they talked about the fact that after 100 years, things are going to be very hot. I mean, we've got the zirconium fuel cladding, which probably will go along with the radioactive waste. And that reacts with water, and that causes hydrogen. And they also said it could get terribly hot, and that it by 100 years would have corroded through any containment that it was put in, and also it shouldn't get wet, but they also found that the pumice mountain at Yucca Mountain let water through. Therefore, they were going to put, after 100 years, titanium baffles over the top of the containment vessels. But, I mean, who would decide to do that? And we'll all be dead. And will our second generation or our great-grandchildren or great-grandchildren know to do that or want to do that? Or
yes.
Yeah.
Well, this is the basic problem. Can we... First of all, is it fair towards the future generations to impose a burden on them in terms of maintenance? Secondly, is it at all possible? Because that will require that knowledge about what it actually is can be carried on. And this is, of course, this question about should we warn / inform the future or not for 100,000 years? That is what Into Eternity is really sort of circling around, and the problem is, of course, that you can also put the argument forward that, in fact, it's better not to inform the future. That is at least actually the preferred strategy in Finland, simply to hide it. And Onkalo, which is the name of the facility, means hiding place. And the idea is that what we are actually fighting here is not a technological problem. We can make a kind of bunker. That's possible, we think. But an even bigger problem is human curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we may have some kind of stone tablets with information, it is still not clear if this will be understood 50,000 years from now.
Well, sure, because, you know, when you think back 2,000 years ago, which we now think is antiquity, that's when Jesus lived.
Yes.
They didn't even speak English. English hadn't been developed.
No.
That's only 2,000 years ago.
Yes. Yes, that is true. Regarding language, what we know for certain, the only thing is that it changes over time.
Yeah.
And that is why we would have problems in understanding a person from the Middle Ages, etc. But if the real problem is human curiosity, somebody would like to open such a place if they found some kind of indication that something is buried here, and you're not able to detect what it is because all knowledge about radiation is gone and you cannot smell it, feel it, or sense it in any way, then you have the real problem, because then you may have somebody who inadvertently opens it and brings out some of the material.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of the village in Brazil where a hospital sent a capsule of cesium-137 to the rubbish dump because they didn't need it anymore, and a family found it, and they found that it glowed blue in the dark, and they used to paint it on their faces, and they ate it, and they put it under their beds and watched it at night. Well, that whole family died, but the whole village was contaminated simply because people had no idea what they were dealing with.
Exactly. And the problem is, of course, also that this may happen and then somebody gets an idea that this is actually dangerous and then it can be used as what we today would call a kind of dirty bomb. So there's also a source of military power in a waste, in a waste repository like this.
You know, I think the Americans choose a million years because when you think about it, plutonium has a half-life of 24,400 years. Some people multiply that by 10 to get the total radiological life, but some multiply it by 20, which brings you up to half a million years. And then you see radioactive iodine-129 has a half-life of 17 million years. And there are quite a few isotopes that have extremely long half-lives. So I suppose to encompass the whole gradient of radioactive elements, and as you said, almost every element is made in a reactor, they've put the number at a million. But it would be interesting, wouldn't it, Michael, to research why the Americans have chosen a million years.
Yes, but, you know, when I asked the scientists in Finland, I received in a way, two kinds of answers within the same company. The communication manager said, Michael, you have to understand that nuclear waste, high-level nuclear waste, becomes less and less toxic because of the half-life. So really, Michael, it's all the time diminishing the problem from day to day. And then the long-term safety expert, or the head of the long-term safety, he said, Michael, I do not agree with this way of talking about high-level nuclear waste, because essentially, when we're talking about these time spans, it is forever. Mm-hmm. In a human time scale, it's forever.
Yes.
I think that is very, very true. Mm-hmm. To talk about 100,000 years or a million years doesn't really make sense. But what we have to think about is that it is about 100,000 years that Homo sapiens left Africa for the first time. That is what we're talking 100, about.
100,000 years. And that's not many generations. I read that the other day.
It's about 3,000 generations.
3,000 generations in 100,000 years. That's not many.
No.
Then we could move on. I know that the Department of Energy in America have been employing anthropologists to work out what sort of signs to put on their radioactive waste dumps, with skull and crossbones, or the scream, or what to put. Would you like to talk about that a bit?
Yes, because this is also what is discussed in Into Eternity, as I refer to these reports, which are just about the only ones in existence in the world.
Anthropological reports?
Yes, and these discussions about what kind of marker could we envision. And the only thing that there has been some kind of consensus about is the scream to be some kind of universal symbol that would be able to be understood by any society, any culture, at any point in time. The problem is, of course, that, it's impossible to test if this is possible, but also you will still need the marker to survive for 100,000 years or a million years in the US.
That's right.
And you will also need this marker to stay at the same point.
Yeah.
I can tell you that there is an interesting case in the US. I think it is the first nuclear test blast. A concrete slab was placed there. I think about a cubic meter or something like that, which then with a plague on. But it's also a cow field, so the cows have been scratching their backs against this concrete slab for 40 years. And now I think it's moved something like 10 meters from this scratching.
And you wouldn't want any earthquakes either, or that sort of thing.
Yes, exactly. And essentially, there are three strategies in terms of communicating towards the future.
Mm.
One is this kind of a marker with a universal symbol on it. The second one is to have a kind of archive system, which is really what the Finnish state opts for and which is discussed in the film. But then that, of course, depends on that one generation actually will pass on the information to the next generation.
Well, what do you mean?
There is a kind of institution.
What do you mean an archive system? I don't understand
well,
that.
Well, the Finnish... The Finnish idea is simply to have a kind of a library, a manned library. A manned library for 100,000 years. People who constantly upgrade the information.
Oh, that's a good idea. How absolutely pathetically, it's like a fairy tale. I mean, God almighty.
Yes, but I have to say that in the film there is the main responsible for this idea. He hesitates a little bit towards where he actually thinks this will take place.
He does.
But the last idea which has been discussed is that if we could create a kind of a myth that would then by itself be retold because of the strength in the narrative from generation to generation, then this would be another way of perhaps passing down information. And Into Eternity, in a way, tries to perform such a task in the way of that it is narratively constructed. But these are the three strategies, and they all have problems.
Well, really, we're talking about Jesus Christ parables that have lasted and passed on generation to generation for 2,000 years. Now, the other thing, talking to you, Michael Madsen, and I'm interviewing Michael Madsen, who made this absolutely wonderful film called Into Eternity, which it's very slow moving, very thought provoking, and people's jaws just drop when they watch it. They hadn't entertained this sort of philosophical approach to what we're actually doing at the moment. We'll get into that in a minute. But, you know, as we talk, Michael, because I'm a pediatrician, a physician, you know, I always say that nuclear waste will produce random compulsory genetic engineering for the rest of time, and that we all carry several hundred genes for disease like cystic fibrosis or diabetes and the like. But as we increase these internal emitters that get into our bodies, into our testicles and ovaries, we will have more and more and more genetic mutations and deformed babies being born. And you could imagine a kind of sort of a mutant population which may not be nearly as intelligent as the one we're dealing with now.
Yeah, I think that the main fear is, of course, mutations stemming from the opening of a such nuclear waste repository. It is not actually who will perhaps die from exposure. It is more if the whole ecosystem receives some kind of imbalance because a creature suddenly becomes superior by mutation.
Yeah.
That is, I think, the main fear.
Really? They expressed that, did they?
They have only gotten so far as to say that, which I believe is extremely cynical, that, such a place inadvertently is opened in the future by somebody who doesn't know.
Yes.
That somebody will die, and then you understand that it's dangerous.
Uh-huh.
And then there is no problem because then it's identified, so to say, as a threat.
Right.
But I believe that the reason why one is going to such extremes as to try to build something for 100,000 years is that it is extremely dangerous and that there are dangers beyond a few casualties.
Like you describe the dangers beyond a few casualties, Michael.
Well, the film Into Eternity does not go into there is, of course, an explanation about what does radiation do to living tissue, to living creatures. And it talks about the instant effects, which is what we have now also seen some of the workers at the Fukushima power plant being exposed to, burns, which is really a burn that will never heal, but also that the aspect of mutation, that the genetic code is not only damaged but also changed. What that will mean, I think nobody knows that. I can tell you that I'm going on a trip next week to the Chernobyl exclusion zone with artists, and one of these artists are, as I understand, taking photographs of insects who have
mutation.
Peculiar shapes.
Yes, and the birds too. The birds, the barn swallows, the insects, yes, and the other animals are showing evidence now of mutation, and it's quite common.
But and that is, I think, that is the main threat. And of course, we have to understand that today all the waste in the world is sitting next to every single power plant in these pools where it needs to be cooled for 40 years at least. If we imagine that these facilities will need to be turned into some kind of permanent solution, then there will be these repositories all over the world. And so it is not only a certain parts of the earth that may have a problem if they leak these facilities. It may be many different zones.
Yes, it will become ubiquitous. When I first wrote my book, Nuclear Madness, back in 1978, I said you can imagine generations hence waking up in the morning, the food already radioactive, the breast milk yes. already radioactive, the children being born deformed or with genetic disease, developing their cancers yeah. at the age of six because they're exposed to radiation so much earlier than getting their yeah. cancers at 60, and that, you know, that's the legacy that we leave to future yeah. generations. And although the Finns are trying to do something about putting this waste deep in the earth, and we'll talk about that in a minute, I can't mm-hmm. see, with the spread of nuclear power all over the world at the moment, the irresponsible spread, I can't see people doing what the Finns have done. Can you, Michael?
Well, I think that, and I am, so to say, trying to stay out of this part of the discussion, because I think that I'm trying to sort of pass on those questions through my film to any individual in the audience.
Yeah.
But I think that it is clear that something needs to be done, because the nuclear waste does exist. And even though you may be against the use of nuclear power, this will not in itself make the nuclear waste go away.
No.
So something needs to be done with the waste we already have.
Yeah.
As we have seen at the Fukushima power plant, also the spent nuclear fuel, the nuclear waste sitting next to the reactors has made troubles, because, of course, the cooling of this waste also went away along with the reactor cooling. And this is the situation all over the world. This can happen at any site in the world with a nuclear power plant. And as is discussed in Intraternity also, the problem of world wars or wars, new states being formed, all of this instability above ground is a real threat to such facilities. And therefore, I could also get the idea that having it buried may be a better solution than having it above ground. Some of the scientists in the film, they told me that they find it very difficult to think that every nation in the world will be able to have such a facility as they are building, due to financial restraints in the third world, so-called third world. But also in a country like Japan, they said they can never build a repository because of the geological conditions. But of course now, in my opinion, I fear that that this is de facto what they have now in the Fukushima, because it'll never be possible to dismantle this wreck of a nuclear power plant. They simply have to cover it up like in Chernobyl.
Yeah, yes. But it's still hot, and Unit 1 is still fissioning.
But that's why if they can get sort of total control, they can only cover it up. But what I think is important to understand in all of this discussion is that 100,000 years is perhaps beyond human comprehension.
Mm.
It is perhaps such a vast time span that we simply cannot relate to it. We may have a similar problem, for example, in Japan. One reason why the authorities, as I understand it, constantly have not been telling the full scope of the events, one reason behind that could be that it is more or less unthinkable that evacuate more than 30 kilometers, perhaps the whole of Tokyo area, etc. These things are sort of bordering on what is not only physically possible, but also to really understand how bad this is can also be difficult to understand, because it's simply sort of outside of human comprehension. And of course, we humans, which is probably a good thing, tend to hope for the best. But in these matters, and as I always say about this film, that, you know, nuclear energy stands on the shoulders of almost all the science, all the scientific knowledge that we have about the universe. It is really the powers of the universe that we are harvesting. so much knowledge is sort of fused together in this technology. And in that sense, it's the hallmark of human civilization. But the flip side is the waste, which has this time span built into it, which I believe is beyond what we can really understand. So on the one hand, it's based on deep understanding in a scientific respect, but it also has this very, very difficult time span for us even to relate to. And then if we cannot relate to it, if we cannot understand it or grasp it, it's suddenly impossible to act responsibly.
I'm interviewing Michael Madsen, who made this incredible film called Into Eternity, and it's about the Onkalo project in Finland. Michael, would you like to describe to the listeners what the project is? What are they doing in Finland?
In Finland, they are trying to create the world's first permanent repository for nuclear waste. So for the first time, it's attempted to create a kind of a bunker-like facility, which half a kilometer down the ground in a system of tunnels will contain the waste of Finland.
It's granite, isn't it? Is it a granite?
Sorry?
Is it granite formation?
Yes, it's granite, yes. This is a granite bedrock.
But does it have, it's got bedrock, but does it have cracks in the granite, you know, so water can
seep
through?
Yes, it has cracks, as I believe all bedrocks have, and of course it is the groundwater flow, which is the main threat to such a facility, because the groundwater is what will flush out the nuclides. But but you also have to understand that any man-made structure is bound to crumble over time. So the Onkalo facility, as I said earlier, meaning hiding place, is really just a delay mechanism. And the idea is that this will delay long enough, 400,000 years at least, to render the waste harmless due to its the half-life, et cetera. But that's the basic idea, to bury it, so to say, having different sort of barrier systems. So if one system fails, another system will still contain the waste, just like you had several city walls around the medieval cities. It's the same idea. If you breach one barrier, you still have another one. What I'm interested in Into Eternity is really the question about communication, and therefore the question about human curiosity. Because even though you have this facility and it is safe, it may not be safe from human curiosity. We know that we have, every time we have found something in the ground or found a pyramid or any burial chamber, we have opened it because we wanted to see what's in there. And as is discussed in the film, this is also conceivable that will happen in the future. Even if you know it's dangerous, you may still want to have a look.
Curiosity killed a cat. Absolutely.
Yes.
How much nuclear waste do the Finns actually have in terms of tonnage, number one? And number two, they're about to open this huge new facility that was built by Areva, a new reactor, Areva, a French company. But there have been terrible problems with the construction. They've drilled holes in the wrong place in the concrete and God knows what, and there's been intrigue and maybe some fraud going on. Would you like to talk about the amount of waste they've got, Michael Madsen, and the new reactor that Areva has been constructing?
The new reactor, to start with that, is only a few kilometers away from the Onkalo facility.
Oh, is it?
And it is true that, yes, and it's true that they have had very, very big difficulties in building it. And we have to understand that if we were comparing nuclear reactors to the car industry, the automobile industry, we would have to say that, well, a nuclear reactor, first of all, is a luxury car. It's the greatest car ever built. The problem with the nuclear industry is, of course, that they have not been building cars since Chernobyl. There has been no new reactors built since Chernobyl.
Since
that, yes, in the Western world. That means that there is basically a lack of knowledge, because the engineers have gone on pension or are dead.
Or they're old.
And you're still trying to build a luxury car.
Yeah, I gathered some information that in France they don't have nearly enough young engineers who understand the nuclear issue, nor physicists. I mean, they're really running out of specialists who know how to run these reactors. Yes. Is that what you're talking about, Michael?
Yes, yes, this is exactly what I'm talking about. And of course, if when you're building something that complex and you don't have not even perhaps the right knowledge anymore, and you're also wanting to sort of build something perhaps even more complex, as it's been claimed, more safe, but you don't have the know-how anymore, then it's of course extremely difficult. And I think this is one of the problems that has been faced in Finland, and I believe that since we were essentially unwanted at the Onkalo facility when making the film, this resistance that we encountered in the last part of the production, I think that came perhaps from the problems that the mother company of the company building Onkalo, which are all private companies, that they encountered with the reactor. So they wanted as little public discussion about the Onkalo facility also.
Oh.
But to return to the amount of waste in Finland, I can't remember the figure, but the idea is that in 120 years from now, 15,000 metric tons is the capacity of the Onkalo facility, and that will by that time hold all of the waste in Finland. But the problem is now that another private operator has been granted a license to build another power plant in Finland, and the capacity or the waste production from this power plant is not calculated in relation to the Onkalo facility. So they will have to build their own facility, also because that the private company Posiva behind the Onkalo facility does not want to. I mean, it's their facility.
Mm.
And what is so weird, in my opinion, about this is that the money that are financing the Posiva company building this facility, and it's something like 3 billion euros is the cost, I believe. That money is coming from a tax taken from the Finnish citizens ever since the nuclear energy production started. So this is paid by every Finnish citizen. But now the know-how rests within a private company, and other companies cannot use this. It's simply a competition parameter. That is a peculiarity in my mind.
So what do you think about private companies building nuclear power plants? I mean, every single nuclear power plant in America has a different design built by private companies. I mean, they're like the plumbing in America. You go into a bathroom, I can never work it out because every single bathroom's different, and it's just the same in nuclear reactors in America.
I think that it is, in my mind, absolutely clear that a private company can only have one goal in this world, and that is to earn money, because that's the logic of private enterprise and the logic of capitalism also. So therefore, it is simply not reasonable to expect from a private company to act beyond its own survival. This is what we see TEPCO do, I think, in Japan. And to believe that they should be acting on behalf of society is simply false. It's a false belief. It's wish thinking that simply does not is not compatible with what a private company is.
So
I don't think you can actually blame a private company of acting on its own in its own interests, because that's the nature of this kind of.
But in the nuclear area, Michael, do you then not believe in capitalism? I don't.
Well, I think my personal opinion, it doesn't really matter. I'm just saying that once you have such a construction, a private company, then you cannot expect it to act differently than what private companies does. Because if you realize that, then you have to say, well, then we simply have to have another system if we want to have control, for example, or have transparency, things like that.
Or have responsibility.
And Yes, of course. And the thing is that as some people they say, radiation does not know any borders, and that's true. As we saw with Chernobyl, the nuclear cloud traveled all over Europe. So there is a problem between, you can say that a private company is acting on its own, in its own interest, in a spot on this earth, but the consequences may travel all over the world. And then you can ask, is that reasonable? Is that ratio fair? Is it even wise? You can ask. That is, I think, the question to put forward.
The thing is, well, there are several things coming out of this conversation too, Michael. With Europe covered with reactors, as it is, the Second World War would have meant that Europe would be uninhabitable for the rest of time. So any country that has nuclear power plants, they can't have wars. You can only fight wars in developing countries that have no reactors or waste repositories.
Yeah.
Would you say that?
Well, you cannot control where a war takes place. But it is clear, let's imagine that the Second World War was happening today with reactors in large parts of Europe. I believe then we again encounter a scenario that is very, very difficult to comprehend, because we would then have to entertain ourselves with the idea that a visit to Paris, Rome, Berlin would be impossible.
Does it worry you, Michael, that you live in Denmark and you travel a lot through Europe and Kazakhstan and the like, that some of the food you're eating is almost certainly radioactive, containing plutonium and cesium and strontium and the like? Do you ever think about that?
No, I don't think about that, again, if I was thinking about that, it would be difficult to go to sleep, or it would be a very long sleep, so to say. So that's one of the problems in this, that if you really think it through, you will get in a very bad mood, most likely.
Or you have to practice psychic. When I go to Europe, I practice what is called psychic numbing, and try and not think about it. But luckily, living in Australia, in the Southern Hemisphere, we have non-radioactive food. We just sell our uranium to the rest of the world, including to Japan. And then we should be advertising the fact that we have non-radioactive food to a radioactive Europe, and we should be selling our food in Europe. But they don't, because they'd rather sell the uranium, I think.
Well, I'm sorry to tell you that ever since the first nuclear test explosions, blasts, the background radiation in the world has been higher than it was before. So you will also have radioactive background radiation at a higher level than it used to be in Australia. But even worse, I can tell you that if you would really want to act responsibly in Australia, I can tell you that one of the perhaps foremost critics, a geologist in Finland, of the Onkalo facility, he said to me that to build a facility like Onkalo in Finland is crazy, because we know that there will be an ice age. This ice age will, the weight of the ice will depress the crust of the earth for 700 meters down.
Oh.
And that will, of course, enhance the fault lines that we know are in the bedrock. So the water flow will increase, and perhaps new fault lines will break into the repository, perhaps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, but if we really want to act responsibly in terms of building such a repository, it has to be in Australia.
Thank you.
Because Australia has the most stable bedrock in the world.
Thank you, Michael.
And there will be no ice ages.
Well, you don't know, there won't be an ice age down here. We're already heading into that situation, because the federal government, in its wisdom, and I'm being sarcastic, has found a place of Aboriginal land. And, you know, who cares about the Aborigines? Let's be frank. We're a very racist country. It's in the Northern Territory and it's called Muckaty Station. And it actually sits atop probably a tributary of the Great Artesian Basin, which is archaeological water that supplies a large part of the continent with water, bore water. The Aborigines are against this. There, we have tremendous monsoonal rains in that area. The Haliburton, which Dick Cheney ran, built the railway line from Darwin to Adelaide, and I think a deal was done by our former Prime Minister John Howard with George W. Bush in the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership to agree that we may receive some of America's radioactive waste. And this bill is being pushed through Parliament despite tremendous opposition by the Indigenous people and many others. I mean, we're already heading in that direction, and it's this area is over probably the Great Artesian Basin. So you might say we've got good bedrock, but and you know, I can't say that we don't deserve it by exporting all this uranium all over the world like there's no tomorrow, and there may not be. You know, maybe,
but
go on.
But perhaps it's not even a question about deserving it or not. If let's just entertain the idea that you didn't even export uranium. Still, if this is the only really, truly suitable place in the world, is it not fair that in the spirit of global brotherhood and sisterhood, that this is where we'll put the waste?
I'm not sure that I'm glad I interviewed you tonight, Michael Madsen. You're making my hackles rise on the back of my neck. Oh, my God. I mean, I see from a philosophical perspective why you would ask that rhetorical question. And I suppose from looking at the aspect of nuclear waste down the ages, the time track, you know, I think it's a reasonable question to ask. God help us.
Actually, I think it is too. The problem is, of course, and this is a problem that will encompass every such a facility, is that in Finland, the argument is that we can put it in the bedrock because the bedrock has been stable for such and such a long time. And therefore, it will also be stable in the future. But it is not a scientific argument to say that because the past looked like that,
yes,
so would the future look like.
Yep.
But that's what the whole thing rests upon in Finland and in any such a repository in the world, wherever they may be built. But the problem is, and that's one of the paradoxes involved in trying to handle nuclear waste responsibly towards the future generations, the problem is that we have nothing to compare with, and we have no ways of testing if it will work, simply because the time span is so big.
Well, and it's kind of
and
like
that's a real problem.
Yes, it's kind of like the Fukushima accident, where five meltdowns occurring, you know, within a few days of each other, and hydrogen explosions left, right, and center. This isn't in the textbooks. This is totally unique in the history of the nuclear age. No one's ever thought about this before. And
no.
But logical people like you and me, I've always said, you can't expect men to be infallible, and we've developed a technology with which we have to be infallible, number one. Number two, you have no idea what nature's going to do. Number three, there could be wars and the like. I mean, you can go on and on and on. Why, Michael Madsen, are you going to go to Chernobyl? I mean, I don't think I'd go there. Or if I did, I would not breathe.
Well, I'm going there in relation to an invitation about thinking about urbanity. But also, I'm working on a new project that will, this trip will also take me to the Kazakhstan, to the Baikonur Cosmodrome, where the Soviet and Russia has been firing the rockets into the sky, and this is partly what my new project is about.
Describe
this is why I'm doing it.
Okay, so describe what's happening in Kazakhstan and what has happened in the past, Michael Madsen.
Well, this is in terms of the new project. I can only talk in that respect.
Yes.
And that is only this is the world's biggest facility for space, for launches into space.
Yeah.
And that's partly my interest for the new film that I'm working on, which I cannot really talk very much about.
No.
So it's simply a new project. But again, it is a project that is trying to look at things from a more, you can say, existential or philosophical angle, because that's my interest, and sometimes that, you know, it, for me, documentary filmmaking is, in a way, you can say, it's a possibility to investigate my own time and to journey into my own time, and that's what I find interesting.
Isn't America cozying up to Kazakhstan at the moment?
I don't know about that, actually. It probably is, but every country is trying to.
Because America's moving into a whole new arms race in space and war in space. In fact, I wrote a book with a man called Craig Eisendrath called War in Heaven, where they're planning to fight war from space down to Earth. It's called the High Frontier.
But that is, and I'm not familiar with that book. I'm listening project. I'm not really interested in that aspect. But I think that if you look at something like the space law from the 60s, the last part of that assembly of principles is really concerned with not using outer space for weaponry of any kind.
That's correct, Michael, but America's not going along with the space law, and it's violating the last part. Oh, my God. Well, look, we're running out of time, but I think you've got the director's note here, and I want to read it out to people because I think it's absolutely profound. And it's from you. I am interested in the areas of documentary filmmaking where additional reality is created. By this I mean that I do not think reality constitutes a fixed entity which accordingly can be documented or revealed in this or that respect. Instead, I suspect reality to be dependent on and susceptible to the nature of its interpretation. I am, in other words, interested in the potentials and requirements of how reality can be and is interpreted. The Onkelo project of creating the world's first final nuclear waste facility, capable of lasting at least 100,000 years, transgresses both in construction and on a philosophical level all previous human endeavours. It represents something new, and as such, I suspect it to be emblematic of our time, and it in a strange way out of time, a unique vantage point for any documentary. Can you just, Michael, enlarge on that last point, out of time, emblematic of time, out of time? Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, I can best explain perhaps by the way the narrative is created in Into Eternity. Into Eternity plays around with the narrative idea of addressing a future audience, an audience far, far away from in time from today. And this address to the future has the idea that when you watch the film, in a way, you are watching the film as if you were looking from 50,000 years from now or 100,000 years, looking back at our time. And this sort of attempt to create this perspective gives, of course, what Brecht would have called this kind of verfremdung or alienation. It gives you a perspective. So suddenly it's possible to look at our own time with another perspective, with other eyes, so to say.
Oh, I see.
And the problem about being contemporary is, of course, always that, as you say in Denmark, you cannot see the forest for the trees because you're in the midst of your own time. But Intertenancy tries to create this perspective of looking back at our own time. And that, I hope, in making the film, that narrative device would, in a way, enable us perhaps to get a glimpse of things that otherwise is in fact invisible for us, or not really to be seen. So this kind of imaginary dialogue with the future is the attempt in this film of trying to put a new kind of gaze upon our contemporary time.
Well, Michael Madsen, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you about your thinking, your philosophy. You're one of the more extraordinary people I think I've ever interviewed, sort of leaping out of our time into the future. And your film is very provocative, Into Eternity. So thank you so much for this really fascinating interview.
Let me just add one last thing, and that is that there is a new documentary film festival, Antenna, coming up in, I think it's from the 6th to the 9th of October in Sydney. And they have invited me to join the festival with Into Eternity. So that would be a chance to see the film and also attend the Q&A, etc.
Wonderful. But also remember, you're also addressing an American and a Canadian audience. So are you going to go to America to some film festivals, Michael?
No, in America it is actually out in several cinemas through international film circuits.
Excellent.
And also in Canada.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much and very good luck on your future projects.
Thank you very much.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Michael Madsen, director of the new documentary film Into Eternity. If you want to listen and podcast our episodes, you may feel free to do that. Just go to our website, If You Love This Planet, and then you can put on quite a lot of programs and listen to them as you're doing the washing up, driving to work, lying in the bath with a glass of red wine, whatever. Also, if you'd like to help with this radio program and you'd like to contribute, there is a donate button now on our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. We'll be back with you with another fascinating program, probably on the nuclear issue next week, as it's so topical at the moment. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.